Welcome to the Positive Energy Podcast, the official podcast of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. We seek to strengthen public confidence in Canada's energy policy, regulation, and decision-making through evidence-based research and analysis, engagement, and recommendations for action. I'm your host, Brendan Frank. Energy regulators have been vital to public policy for over a century, both as hubs of technical expertise and as deliberative bodies capable of looking beyond electoral cycles. Under this paradigm, Canadian regulators have emerged as reputable decision makers and enforcers of the public interest, ruling on everything from megaprojects to the marginal pennies on our electricity bills. The concept of regulatory independence is central to this arrangement. Independent, arm's length, trusted. Regulatory bodies are evolving constantly, both in their independence and in the effectiveness of their decision making. As we've discussed on previous episodes of this podcast, the dynamics inside and outside of the sector are changing. New environmental imperatives, greater calls for public participation, broader consideration of Indigenous rights, and greater political fragmentation and polarization are all reshaping the roles and responsibilities of regulators. To paraphrase the talking heads, how did we get here? Today we're speaking with Ian T.D. Thompson, who has been working on this question for over a year as part of Positive Energy's Policymakers, Regulators, Courts project. His forthcoming report is entitled The History of Canada's Key Energy Regulators Through the Lens of Regulatory Independence, and he's joining us today to discuss his findings. A final synthesis report for this project, authored by Positive Energy Senior Fellow Mike Cleland and Positive Energy Chair Monica Gattinger, will synthesize insights from the case studies along with other research from the Roles and Responsibilities research stream. Ian is a research associate with Positive Energy and the former host of this podcast. He holds a master's in public policy from the University of Toronto's Monk School, and he will be attending law school at U of T this fall. Welcome, Ian.
Well, thanks so much, Brendan. Happy to be on.
This report sits within a larger body of work on regulatory independence. Could you talk briefly about this constellation of projects and how your report fits in?
Right. And you're absolutely right on just the term of the constellation of projects. This has been a very large undertaking by Positive Energy, being part of the Roles and Responsibilities research stream. And within that stream, it's kind of a larger body of work called the Policy Regulators and Courts Project. So this, as you mentioned, I've been kind of undergoing this research for a number of months now. And it's led to a number of a big body, a breadth of research that has been published since then. Last November, we released a literature review on regulatory independence. We had a discussion paper on preliminary analysis that we found with the research as well as with expert interviews. We had an energy expert workshop in, I think it was like October or in fall 2020, just to be safe, on those two documents. And then we had released a report kind of on the key takeaways from that workshop. And essentially this report is then they're kind of the extension of this project. And it explores, as you mentioned in the show about the title, it explores the kind of five key energy regulators as case studies, the Canada Energy Regulator, formerly the National Energy Board, the Alberta Energy Regulator and its predecessors, the Ontario Energy Board, the Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board, and the BC Oil and Gas Commission. So it is kind of seen as the extension of those of all that previous work, and we're certainly really excited to see it out there and for people to give it a read.
So before we get into the guts of those case studies that you mentioned, could you give us a working definition of regulatory independence, just so we're all on the same page? And maybe you could explain why it's so important for effective regulation as well.
Yeah. And when you sent me this question, I'm like, oh God, this is a doozy, because like it is a complex paradigm, and it's something that we've been doing a lot of research on. When we think of regulatory independence, people might have their own unique idea, and there's just so many parts of regulatory independence. Just to give you an example, kind of you have judicial independence, which is what the judicial branch possesses, and a lot of times regulatory independence is seen is evaluated with that concept in mind. You have perceived independence, i.e., you know, whether the public or other actors or the regulator perceive itself or the regulator to be independent and have the capacity to make its own decisions. And then you have just procedural independence. Is the process protected by the political interference? And can the regulatory make the decision outside of that political process? It's a complicated paradigm, and it's something, it's part of the reason why we asked all of our expert interviews that question. How would you define regulatory independence as a general concept? And we kind of came to a few key ideas, I think, that are worth just briefly mentioning right now. Independence is in reference to that regulatory procedure and decision-making, and kind of the outcomes. You know, it's free of bias. It has the appropriate expertise and knowledge. Independence isn't like an absolute concept. It's also often quite relative from regulator to regulator, and also between the functions of a single regulator. Often independence is seen as relative to government. It's not completely independent of government, but it is relative to the government of the day or the executive branch. And then it's a notion that the regulator needs to be kind of independent from all the interests of all the sides, actors in an issue, behave impartially, and make decisions free of bias. So again, it's an interesting concept to unpack, and that's part of the reason why this project exists, to hopefully get a little bit more to that notion. And the reason why you have independence, ultimately to your second part of the question of effective regulation, is precisely to let the regulator and its expertise flourish, its adjudicative process flourish, to touch on key elements of effectiveness, timeliness of decision, stability of decision, ways, as well as maybe appeal to long-term imperatives that the political process can't really touch upon. There's a short-term element to a lot of politics. In 4 years, you could have a completely new government, whereas an agency, a regulator, might be allowed to make more long-term decisions. So again, regulatory independence is a challenge to define, but hopefully that might set the stage a little bit more for our discussion on the case studies.
So on that note, the case studies, you mentioned that you looked at the Canada Energy Regulator, the Alberta Energy Regulator, the Ontario Energy Board, Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board, and the BC Oil and Gas Commission. So what emerged from those five cases? What are the common threads between them when we're thinking about regulatory independence?
There were a lot of very similar contextual drivers at play across Canada's history. So for instance, the 90s saw this real big appeal to economic efficiency, deregulation, streamlining of services, which ultimately saw the governments really reform their regulators in different ways. So in Alberta, you had the two energy regulators merge under the quote-unquote Klein Revolution. The NEB processes were kind of more streamlined. The Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board was created, and that was compiled of a bunch of other regulators and tribunals at the time to kind of create this one amalgamated super regulator, as it's called. Similarly, in the 2000s, you see greater appeals and greater desire for expansion of environmental considerations, climate change, expanding role for First Nations in Crown consultation and decision-making, as well as just greater calls for public participation. And so those are common threads that kind of really do show up throughout all the stories of these five regulators. And so they show up in various degrees, and maybe we'll get to the differences a bit later. That said, you know, there were also how they kind of reacted to these drivers in some cases were quite similar. So as mentioned, consolidation did occur in Nova Scotia and Alberta for its regulators in the 90s. In Alberta and at the federal level in the 2010s, both governments imposed kind of similar reforms to enhance competitiveness of the energy sector and the timeliness of regulatory decision-making through various pieces of legislation, both federally and at Alberta. So what I'm kind of getting at with this answer is that each jurisdiction has kind of engaged in the very similar trends. You know, the trends have kind of all been there in all of the stories of these five regulators. Even right now, like at least three of these regulators have imposed very similar governance structures called the tripartite model. So it's very interesting to kind of see that, like fashion, like music, regulators, despite their independence, are influenced by kind of the present trends and societal drivers of present day.
So I would really like to talk about areas of divergence, which you hinted at there, but I want to pause on another idea that you put on the table, which is the idea of reaction time. You just described these societal trends unfolding over a span of decades, but have regulators been quick when we think about day-to-day operations month over month, year over year to respond to these trends?
Oh, geez, that's a good question. My initial inclination would be no, but that's also unfair to say. It's difficult to sum up in a single macro yes, no, I would say. In some cases, you know, it has been a struggle to address some of these social changes, these social imperatives. In some cases, I think that they've done a very incremental job. I mean, you look at Nova Scotia and its imposing of kind of renewable targets. The Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board has been there as a stable force. You know, so whether or not it's quick is one thing, but effectiveness may not necessarily mean always just quick and timely. It maybe just appeals to other imperatives. You know, stakeholders want to incorporations of environmental consideration, investors want some stability in the process, and regulators are able to give that. So whether or not they're able to make it quick isn't always the case. I think in some cases it might be, but again, that might not necessarily be the correct metric to judge these entities.
And going back to the question of divergence across the five case studies, what were the areas of divergence? Do any of these regulators have unique features or processes that really stood out to you?
Oh, 100%. And that's part of the reason why on the onset, we talked about the five case studies and two of those, we kind of call the outliers. We call BC Oil and Gas Commission an outlier. We call the Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board an outlier, just because you have the first three at the federal level, Alberta, Ontario. There has been a lot of research on these over time, whereas Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board and BC less so. But insofar as their actual structures play out compared to those first three, they're very unique. And just to kind of provide just a very brief overview, like the BC Oil and Gas Commission is the newest one. It was only made in 1998. Secondly, it's not a tribunal like these other agencies. Its governance structure resembles that of more of a corporate agency. And that plays a huge role in how independent it be under certain factors and metrics. In Nova Scotia has been technically around for a long time, since like the early 20th centuries with the Public Utilities Board there. But it's very unique because the current iteration of the Nova Scotia Utility Review Board has a massive, it administers like 40 statutes. It's not just electricity, it does utilities, gas prices, auto insurance, payday loans. It just does everything. And that's why people have called it a super regulator. It's also incredibly, it also possesses like notions of independence that are quite akin to, as I mentioned earlier, judicial independence. It is very court-like in how it behaves. It's very stable and it is a trusted force in Nova Scotia. So that's the reason why we included those two. And I just want to mention one last thing. So I mentioned how sometimes regulators handle these challenges similarly, but conversely, they also have handled it quite differently. To take just a quick example, in Ontario, you have the Green Energy Act, which really was a driving force to see forth renewable energy in the province. And it ultimately did have an effect on how the OEB functions. It functions more as a kind of a government agency and technical implementer rather than an independent adjudicative regulator. Whereas in Nova Scotia, again, you know, they've tackled renewable energy, but they haven't done so at the cost of an independent regulator. And in fact, they've used their economic regulator, the Nova Scotia Utility and Review Board, to impose kind of incremental steps through their adjudicative hearing process through the use of their expertise. So here we have a situation where you have two different regulators, a very similar challenge that they're facing in terms of incorporating renewables onto their grid, but very different solutions.
So you've offered a few ideas here, and I think one of the concepts that's emerging is there are trade-offs between different models of regulatory independence. So your report makes reference to looking forward by looking back, and I'd like to look forward for a moment. When we think about these new imperatives for energy regulators and perceptions of their independence and the trade-offs that come with that independence, what should decision makers and regulators be thinking about as we look ahead to net zero by 2050 as sort of a guiding light?
Obviously, net zero is a very it's a massive challenge. You know, it requires cooperation across all the actors in the system, industry, advocacy groups. Governments really can't do that unilaterally, just by themselves through the executive. And this is where maybe arm's length regulators can really enhance the pursuit of this goal. There's a lot of benefits to this model. Again, this model grew out of the 1800s with a desire to really realize that they work better than the courts. They possessed expertise and they could move quickly, but also weren't subject to kind of short-term political goals, or at least theoretically. So they possess expertise. They can look forward into a more long-term trajectory that might actually be needed with 2050. These regulators have shown to kind of evolve over time, and I think they will evolve with 2050. But I think decision makers do need to take into account how these entities fit in with that goal in mind, and kind of the elements of independence and effectiveness. There are various elements of effectiveness that might need to change and be altered. In some cases, regulators have evolved to meet kind of the needs and the challenges of their jurisdictions, and to be shown to kind of enhance important public policy discourse and imperatives of the day. I'm not saying there haven't been failures, but regulators shouldn't also be seen as nuisances to reaching those substantive goals, such as net zero. So essentially, you know, my takeaway be for decision makers, for folks in government, would be to just, you know, they need to determine where these entities sit and where their relative independence needs to be in order to reach these very substantive long-term goals that may require both their adjudicative process as well as their unique format in which to regulate in the public interest.
Ian T.D. Thompson is our guest today. His report with Positive Energy will be out in the coming weeks. Thank you so much for joining us, Ian.
Absolutely. This has been a great conversation.
You've been listening to the Positive Energy Podcast. To see more of our research and to find out about upcoming events, check out our website. Today's episode was recorded on the traditional and unceded territory of the Algonquin people. It was produced by Alicia Aziz, Raphael Desordi, and myself, Brendan Frank. We'll be back soon. See you later.